Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We are going to start in the Hollywood section, move over to the Hollywood issue. So I'll talk about a couple more men on the cover of the Hollywood issue. We'll check in with the royals and end with politics. If there's time, there is a Proust questionnaire, so we'll see how that goes. We're starting in the Hollywood section, and our first headline is a follow-up to a story that I brought you next week. A decision has been made. As Netflix swallows Warner Brothers, Hollywood is in full-blown panic mode. Everyone's just like, how is David Zaslav going to make so much money when he ran the company into the ground, says a studio executive. The unjustness of that, when all these people are going to be out of work, it should be illegal. This is by Rebecca Ford and Joy Press on December 5th. On Thursday night, Netflix threw a holiday party for some of its departments at Los Angeles restaurant Delilah, decorating the cozy space with a Tinseltown old Hollywood theme. But the holiday cheer quickly dissipated, at least for everyone besides Netflix executives, after word began to spread that the streamer had won the bidding war to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery. The news became official Friday morning with the announcement that Netflix had entered into a definitive agreement to buy Warner Brothers in an $82.7 billion deal. There's nothing more old Hollywood than Warner Brothers, a storied movie studio established in 1923, one of the Big Five created during Hollywood's golden age, which is precisely why many Hollywood insiders are taking this news so hard. If this deal does go through, Netflix, the streaming giant that swooped in and disrupted the old system, or destroyed it, depending on your point of view, will take control of one of the last remaining Hollywood studios, plus all the IP and history that goes along with it. It's not just one less buyer, it's the triumph of the Netflix business model, which is to be the only player in the business, building on years and years of successful work by the creatives they're now going to fuck over, one award-winning TV and film writer tells Vanity Fair. Provided the acquisition does go through, Netflix will take the studio's most valuable assets, its film and television studios, including HBO Max and HBO. The acquisition doesn't include Warner Brothers Discovery's Global Networks division, which will be spun off into a separate publicly traded company called Discovery Global, comprising brands like CNN and TNT Sports as previously planned. The outrage has been swift among the Hollywood community. A group of anonymous A-list producers has already released a statement against the merger, saying it would effectively hold a noose around the theatrical marketplace. Major unions like the Directors Guild of America, the Producers Guild, and the Writers Guild have all released statements expressing concern. The outcome would eliminate jobs, push down wages, worsen conditions for all entertainment workers, raise prices for consumers, and reduce the volume and diversity of content for all viewers, says a statement from the WGA. Industry workers, along with the public, are already impacted by only a few powerful companies maintaining tight control over what consumers can watch on television, on streaming, and in theaters. This merger must be blocked. One of the biggest concerns from many insiders is how Netflix will approach theatrical releases of Warner Brothers movies. A statement from the company said that Netflix expects to maintain Warner Brothers' current operations and build on its strengths, including theatrical releases for films. I'd say that right now you should count on everything that is planned on going to the theaters through Warner Brothers will continue to go to the theaters through Warner Brothers, said Netflix co-CEO Ted Sarandos in a conference call with investors after the announcement of the acquisition. Sarandos also argued that Netflix already put movies in theaters, though he didn't say how long those theatrical releases are. We've released about 30 films into theaters this year, so it's not like we have this opposition to movies in theaters, he added. My pushback has been mostly in the fact of the long exclusive windows, which we don't think are that consumer friendly. Most Netflix films, like recent releases and Oscar hopefuls Frankenstein and Jay Kelly, are released in select theaters for a mere 2 weeks before hitting the streaming service, if at all. By contrast, Warner Brothers' theatrical releases traditionally stay in theaters for around 30 to 45 days. Sarandos has been very vocal with his feelings about those exclusivity windows. Cinema United, which represented over 30,000 movie screens in all 50 states, expressed concern about what the merger might mean for theatrical films in a strong statement, describing it as an unprecedented threat to the global exhibition business. The negative impact of this acquisition will impact theaters from the biggest circuits to one-screen independents in small towns in the United States and around the world, said Cinema United president and CEO Michael O'Leary. Cinema United stands ready to support industry changes that lead to increased movie production and give consumers more opportunities to enjoy a day at the local theater. But Netflix's stated business model does not support theatrical exhibition. In fact, it's the opposite. Despite Netflix's public posture, insiders worry that the company's lip service to theatrical windows will change quickly once the deal is done. It's real enough to control the initial PR wave, but they're being vague about theatrical release plans, and they're being vague about their commitment to Warner Brothers TV studios, because Netflix has never made products for other competitors, an agent tells Vanity Fair. Right now, Warner Brothers TV produces shows not only for Warner-owned services and channels, but for other networks, like Abbott Elementary, which airs on ABC, Netflix's own Running Point, and Apple TV's Presumed Innocent. While Netflix would gain a large-scale TV production studio in WBTV, it would also for the first time be making content meant for other distributors, if it kept the model as is. Overall, the dissolution of any studio in its independent form is a hit to Hollywood, especially those who make movies and try to sell them to the studios to distribute. It's worse to have fewer buyers, you just have fewer options. The studios have more leverage and it breeds less risk-taking, says a film producer. The climate has been one of tapping down advocacy. It's as if people are serving accounts. People are looking to safety as opposed to innovation. Job losses are inevitable if the acquisition goes through. In a community that's been buffeted by countless challenges over the past few years, from the pandemic to the 2023 strikes, it's a bitter pill to swallow. Those inside Warner Brothers Discovery are still recovering from Warner Media's merger with Discovery, which happened less than 4 years ago and resulted in significant layoffs. Everyone's just like, how the fuck is WBD CEO David Zaslav going to make so much money when he ran the company into the ground, says a studio executive. The unjustness of that, when all these people are going to be out of work, it should be illegal. At least one lawmaker has something to say about that, too. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren described the potential deal as an anti-monopoly nightmare in a statement Friday, adding, a Netflix Warner Brothers would create one massive media giant with control of close to half of the streaming market, threatening to force Americans into higher subscription prices and fewer choices over what and how they watch, while putting American workers at risk. There's a long road ahead with a corporate acquisitions process subject to regulatory approval by the federal government. A merger wouldn't close until after WBD's Global Networks division, Discovery Global, spins out into a new publicly traded company, which the Netflix release stated is pushed to Q3 2026. If Washington had any balls, there would be bipartisan agreement to implement a new form of Paramount decrees to keep movies and television a healthy and competitive market, says the TV writer. They're referring to the Paramount Decrees of 1948, considered a bedrock of corporate antitrust law, which were created to prevent movie studios having a monopoly over the production and distribution of films. Those laws were overturned in 2020, but at least some in Hollywood feel like Washington has to get involved in the ever-growing threat to Hollywood as we knew it. But as Deadwood's Al Swearingen might say, the TV writer adds, we ain't that fucking lucky. We're moving to the Hollywood issue. Our first guy from the cover, Callum Turner, would spend eternity right here. He believes in therapy, texts with Daniel Day-Lewis, and is marrying Dua Lipa. Who can blame Hollywood for anointing this affable Brit? This is by Savannah Walsh. There's a disarming normalcy to Callum Turner, the roguish Brit with gray-blue eyes that matches his zip-up track jacket. Those same eyes crinkle at the edges as he smiles, awkwardly angling his Zoom camera and politely shooing away a hotel employee from the sterile Los Angeles suite in which he sits. Humble but cheeky, Turner speaks so casually that it takes a beat too long to realize that when he talks about texting with Daniel, he means Daniel Day-Lewis. He and the three-time Oscar winner are buddies, says Turner. We would speak on the phone and text each other movies that the other person should see. We built a nice little friendship. He said something to me that was really freeing, actually. Dance to the rhythm of your own beat. If you want to be a soap star, be a soap star. If you want to be in franchise movies, be in franchise movies. It's your personal journey. Day-Lewis's advice helped launch the former Burberry model and current Louis Vuitton ambassador to a flourishing film career as Eddie Redmayne's suave brother in the Fantastic Beasts franchise, a listless Manhattanite in The Only Living Boy in New York, and the dashing scoundrel Frank Churchill in 2020's Emma. Not bad for a guy who only realized he wanted to act at age 20. When I first started, someone said, "You're too tall to act." Turner recalls with a disbelieving shrug. Jacob Elordi is 6'7". Fuck. Elordi is actually 6'5", to Turner's 6'2". Imagine if I listened to that person, he said, shaking his head. But the feedback taught Turner an important lesson. People ultimately don't know what the hell they're talking about most of the time and have an opinion based on their experiences of life, not your experience. Turner gave himself a decade to prove his worth, landing roles in two major projects around the age of 30, as a World War II pilot in the Apple TV limited series Masters of the Air, and as an Olympic rower in George Clooney's The Boys in the Boat. The timing wasn't a coincidence. Once you get to your 30s, you just know yourself better, the now 35-year-old Turner says. Up until 26, 27, I was flying blind. I did a lot of therapy. It wasn't like I had a great trauma that I was stuck within. I just wanted to keep behavior patterns that I really liked and let go of ones that I didn't. If you don't have a good relationship with yourself, then you can't have relationships with other people that are grounded in truth. Raised by a single mother in a working-class enclave of London's Chelsea neighborhood, Turner grew up idolizing Robert De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio. As he got older, he embraced the golden age charms of Montgomery Clift and Gary Cooper. Then, as he entered the industry, the edgier exploits of Cillian Murphy and Tom Hardy. These influences seemed to converge in two new high-concept films in which he's starring. Mark Jenkins' meditative Rose of Nevada sees Turner, and 1917's George MacKay play fishermen transported back in time under increasingly mysterious circumstances. A24's Eternity stars Elizabeth Olsen as the recently deceased Joan, who winds up stranded in the afterlife with her two late husbands, played by Turner and Miles Teller, and is forced to choose with whom she'd rather spend forever. It's a running joke in the movie that Luke, who died in combat, is the perfect man. I hated that part of the script, actually, Turner says, because if you're being defined by your looks solely, then that isn't a true representation of who you are. My character is about being set free, ultimately. Being set free from himself, from the idea of what he wants to present, this matinee idol gentleman. Turner has also learned to let go of outside expectations, particularly those relating to his relationship with his fiancée, Grammy-winning pop star Dua Lipa, whom he charmed over drinks before a mutual friend's birthday party in Los Angeles. As Turner remembered it in the Sunday Times, both were finishing the first chapter of Herman Diaz's Trust. "So we're on the same page," Turner told Lipa in a line for the ages. "There's nothing hard about it at all," he says when asked about navigating a public romance, though his rosy cheeks suggest otherwise. "It's the easiest thing in the world, it really is." Except when onlookers try to sneakily snap a photo of him and Lipa living their lives. Of course it's annoying when somebody's videoing you, but for the most part, people are incredibly respectful and generous, Turner says. That said, there's a lot of things that pop up saying we're going to buy a house, places that I've never even heard of. People say, are you going to buy a house somewhere in Spain? That came up yesterday. That's pretty outlandish. For now, Turner has different goals in mind. He is starring opposite Monica Barbaro in the Will Gluck-directed romantic comedy One Night Only, and will play a British filmmaker facing a life crisis as he visits the Arabian Desert for a job in Ben Sherrick's All Alone Together, also featuring Adria Arjona. But settling down is more of a priority these days. I get to travel so much that just being home would be my ideal eternity, being in my own city, he says. I know my version of London so well. That's definitely a pub, parks that I go to with my dog, a Labrador Rottweiler mix named Golo, and cinemas that are my favorite. My family and my friends would be there. That's the most important. Those who die in eternity transition back to the physical body in which they were most content. If that happens when Turner meets his end, he'd like to revisit this version of himself, because I'm happiest now in my life. Our next Hollywood leading man. Just try to pin down Lakeith Stanfield. From Atlanta to Get Out to the next Boots Riley movie, Stanfield has mastered the art of mystery. I love a cunning character that's always plotting. This is by Joe Hagen. Like an apparition, Lakeith Stanfield appears from behind a column, tall and rangy in a Yankees cap and Gucci loafers, a sly expression on his face. It's a perfectly Lakeith Stanfield moment, delightful and a little creepy, an echo of his role as Andre, the haunted character from Jordan Peele's Get Out, probably the movie most responsible for putting Stanfield on the map. I've always been mischievous, he tells me. I think that's what I like about characters, too. It's like finding little things about them that are just off of what there was on the page. In the last few years, Stanfield has earned a reputation as a somewhat mysterious and private actor. On screen, his half-lidded eyes and laid-back smile telegraph unpredictable eccentricity, a mix of laconic, comic, weird, and vulnerable that seemed to appear fully formed in Cassius, the awkward protagonist of Boots Riley's Sorry to Bother You, and Darius, the drug dealer come philosopher in FX's Atlanta. Here in New York, where he's filming Taylor Sheridan's upcoming thriller, Fast, Stanfield seems ready to go off script yet again. As a confessional, emotionally open, and deeply inquisitive actor, working to balance leading man ambitions with his relatively new role as a husband and father. Stanfield has three children, including a new baby by wife Casimir Treese, and has gone through extensive therapy to adjust to a life as a rising star, especially after his Oscar-nominated performance in Judas and the Black Messiah. I've tried to stifle my emotions before for reasons of survivability, but I don't think that's me, he says. I think that I'm a person who feels a lot of things, and I think that's okay. I think I have to allow myself to do that, and I think that my part of my authenticity is just to feel and to share. Stanfield's tattooed arms are a reminder of how far he's come. One of his more recent additions, the letter A on his right arm, was done while filming Atlanta, but most were made by a gangster dude who lived around the corner from my house in the hardscrabble suburb of Victorville, California, where he grew up. The first one, which cost him $5, was his mother's name, Karen, with the phrase, "True love of my life." Stanfield's mother raised him and his two brothers on a salary from fast food restaurants, and his choice of tribute to her was calculated to mitigate her disapproval. And then, once I got away with that one, he says, I got, like, tat fever. His latest ink, the word magnolia over his right eyebrow, which is both the street he grew up on and the name of his daughter. Stanfield's early impressions of acting came from seeing Larenz Tate in Menace to Society and Sidney Poitier in To Sir with Love. But he also loved comic stars like Robin Williams and especially Jim Carrey, whose rubber-faced transformations on the TV show In Living Color were an early influence. I was like, I want to be like that, he says. Stanfield joined the drama club in high school, signing to a modeling agency, and landed his first significant role in 2013 in an indie film called Short Term 12, which saw him co-star with Rami Malek. Finding his way in Hollywood wasn't easy. A rap single he released this year, Fast Life, was written during his first brush with fame after Get Out, when he was overindulging in alcohol and surrounding himself with hangers-on. I had a bunch of people around me doing all their different vices, he recalls, and I'm drinking and I'm like, good, drugs and friends, which became a repeated lyric. In retrospect, none of those people were actually my friends. When you're not primed and mature and don't have the strength yet to navigate it, it can be an all-encompassing and consuming. So I had a lot to learn when I wrote that song. The title of another song is a reminder to himself, Do Better. He says therapy helped him separate himself from the characters he inhabits. There's often very little distinction between what you're experiencing as an actor and real life, he says. For sure, your body doesn't know, but sometimes your mind just doesn't know either, and you have to go through rituals to alert your body and your spirit that this is not real. Stanfield uses an app that forces him to breathe for a few seconds before he can open his phone in the morning. He spends a lot of time online researching arcane subjects like the speed of light and German philosophy. He gravitates toward Nietzsche and Schopenhauer, or discover films he missed, like Yi Yi, the gorgeous 2000 Taiwanese film. The internet, he said, can be terrible, but it also reminds him that we're all kind of living the same experience. In acting, as well as in life, he values authenticity. He admires icons like Marlon Brando, Denzel Washington, Johnny Depp, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, especially, he says, in Capote. But he also gets inspiration from actors he's worked with closely, like James McAvoy, with whom he co-starred in The Book of Clarence. One of his favorite people to watch isn't an actor at all, but his own younger brother, who suffers from severe autism. He doesn't really speak English, but he communicates in so many ways, in his gesticulations and expressions and the way he moves, Stanfield says. He's one of the most interesting people I've ever seen because he's nothing but 110% authentic all the time, and there's a certain freedom in that that I love. This year, Stanfield brought his peculiar presence to two critically acclaimed films, appearing alongside Channing Tatum in Roofman and with Jennifer Lawrence in Die My Love. Next year, he'll be starring in new Boots Riley movie, I Love Boosters. He won't reveal much about it, only saying that it's one of the craziest things I've ever played. It's like the most fun I think I've had since Sorry to Bother You. Looking ahead, he's hungry for more complex and riskier roles. He'd love to play a well-written villain, he said, like Heath Ledger's in The Dark Knight or Bryan Cranston's in Breaking Bad. Says Stanfield, I love a cunning character that always plotting something that other people don't really know what he's plotting. We've noticed. We're moving to the royals section. Our first headline, Meghan Markle has been estranged from her father for years. Will his medical emergency change that? On Wednesday, Thomas Markle Sr. reportedly underwent a leg amputation in the Philippines, where the 81-year-old lives with Meghan's half-brother, Thomas Markle Jr. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on December 5th. Meghan Markle's estranged father, Thomas Markle, 81, is reportedly in intensive care in a Philippines hospital following a leg amputation Wednesday. Meghan's half-brother, Thomas Markle Jr., told the Daily Mail that his father's lower leg was amputated following the discovery of a blood clot in his left thigh. I was told the leg had to be removed and it was a case of life or death, Markle Jr. told the tabloid. His foot turned blue and then black, and it happened very quickly. I took him to a local hospital and they did some scans and an ultrasound and said the leg had to be amputated. Meghan's father and half-brother are both currently living in the densely populated province of Cebu. Markle Sr. relocated to the island earlier this year following a decade spent living in Rosarito, Mexico. In January, he told the Daily Mail's Caroline Graham that he was moving in hopes of having a quieter, friendlier existence and to enjoy good medical care and healthy food. According to a family insider who spoke to the Daily Record in May, Markle Sr. was living in a high-rise apartment for about 500 British pounds, or $670 a month, and being cared for by his son. Spokespeople for the Duchess of Sussex did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Meghan has been estranged from her father since the run-up to her 2018 wedding to Prince Harry. Staged photos of the elder Markle in Mexico appeared in a tabloid just days before the wedding, and the father of the bride subsequently decided not to attend the ceremony, citing health concerns. The details of what really happened between Meghan and her father behind the scenes didn't become public until 3 years later. In their joint interview with Oprah Winfrey in 2021, Meghan and Harry said that they asked Markle Sr. if he was cooperating with tabloid journalists, and he claimed that he hadn't. Meghan said the lie was hard for her to reconcile, particularly after becoming a mother herself. Days later, Markle Sr. finally admitted to Piers Morgan on Good Morning Britain that, in fact, he had been working with tabloid journalists to stage the photos. "I wish I hadn't done the whole thing," he said, adding that he made his decision after enduring a year of unflattering paparazzi pictures. "I went for this deal where this man was going to make me look better. Maybe I got sucked into it, but I believed him and I thought it was going to work. It didn't work, of course." Meghan hasn't commented publicly on her relationship with her father since the 2022 documentary, Harry and Meghan. In his 2023 memoir, Spare, Harry mentioned that the controversy over Meghan's relationship with her father caused a strain in the couple's relationship with the royal family as well. Markle has said that he hasn't met his grandchildren, Prince Archie, who is 6, and Princess Lilibet, who is 4. Markle's public comments about his daughter have gotten increasingly vitriolic over the last few years. In March, he disparaged her new show with Love, Meghan in another interview with Graham. "Unfortunately, Meghan has never been authentic. She has to think about everything. She's not spontaneous," he said. "I know when she's faking it for the cameras. She's trying so hard to be perfect that she tenses up every time the camera's on her." Markle Sr. is a retired Hollywood lighting director who met Meghan's mother, Doria Ragland, while working on set. Ragland and Markle divorced when Meghan was 6 years old, though he remained a part of her life and helped fund her education. Ragland continues to be close to Meghan and Harry and has played an active role in raising their children. On Wednesday, the With Love, Meghan holiday special premiered on Netflix. During a short cameo, Harry praised his mother-in-law's cooking. Our next royal headline, Prince William visits Gaza children recovering in British hospitals. The Prince of Wales wanted to offer a moment of comfort to these young people who have been through experiences that no child should have to endure, says a Kensington Palace spokesperson. This is by Blanche Marcel on December 2nd. As conflict in Gaza rages on, Prince William met injured young patients being cared for in several British hospitals. The prince wanted to offer a moment of comfort to these young people who have been through experiences that no child should have to endure, a Kensington Palace spokesperson told People magazine. Highly admiring of the work done by the National Health Service, or NHS, staff during this extremely difficult time, the prince was keen to express his immense gratitude by paying a private visit. His Royal Highness was touched by the courage of the children and their families, and by the dedication of the team who are supporting them with such professionalism and humanity, added the spokesman. These young patients are being cared for as part of a government humanitarian mission set up after the collapse of the medical system in Gaza following the conflict. Prince William has been closely following this region for several years. In 2018, during his official trip to Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, he met former Israeli President Reuven Rivlin, as well as Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Prince William thus became the first member of the British royal family to make an official visit to Israel, as People magazine points out. And the future king didn't just observe from afar. In early 2024, he issued a rare statement on the conflict before visiting British Red Cross headquarters in London. "I remain deeply concerned by the terrible human cost of the conflict in the Middle East since the Hamas terrorist attack on October 7th, he said at the time. "Too many people have been killed." I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Once again, my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article about Prince William visiting children in a hospital. Like so many others, I want to see an end to this fighting as soon as possible. Humanitarian aid to Gaza must be stepped up as a matter of urgency. It is crucial that it reaches its destination and that the hostages are released, Prince William continued. It is sometimes only when faced with the scale of human suffering that we fully appreciate the importance of lasting peace. He concluded, even in the darkest hours, we must not give in to despair. I continue to cling to the hope of a better future, and I refuse to give up. We are moving into the politics section. Our first headline, Donald Trump finally gets his Peace Prize from FIFA head Gianni Infantino. FIFA's 2026 World Cup draw celebrated Trump with a trophy, medal, and one of the greatest honors of my life. This is by Aidan McLaughlin on December 6th. You would be forgiven for wondering what exactly was being celebrated at Friday's 2026 World Cup draw in Washington. The splashy event, hosted by FIFA at the Kennedy Center and watched by millions around the world, was nominally held to determine groups for next year's World Cup in the United States, Mexico, and Canada. In practice, it was a carefully curated celebration of President Donald Trump. The festivities kicked off with a performance from Andrea Bocelli, Trump's favorite tenor, who wore a blue velvet tuxedo and aviator sunglasses as he belted out Nessun Dorma. Trump sat in an opera box emblazoned for the occasion with the presidential seal, looking on intently. The closing act was none other than the Village People, whose gay anthem YMCA has been a staple of Trump's campaign rallies. The highlight was the presentation of the newly invented FIFA Peace Prize, which was awarded without much suspense to Donald Trump. A hagiographic video was played which applauded the president for his Abraham Accords, which he oversaw in his first term, as well as a long list of peace treaties Trump has taken credit for. That included a few, like the one between Serbia and Kosovo, which do not exist, and the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas, which, despite the agreement, remain embroiled in a bloody conflict. This is your prize. This is your peace prize, Gianni Infantino, the head of the soccer's governing body and host of the event, told the U.S. president. He presented Trump with a large gold trophy, a certificate proving the legitimacy of the award, and a beautiful medal for you can wear everywhere you go. Trump obliged, putting the medal around his neck. This is truly one of the great honors of my life, Trump said. We've saved millions and millions of lives. Of all the flattery campaigns directed at Trump by foreign leaders and business titans and his oh-so-transactional second term, the draw stood out. The event was the theatrical culmination of a months-long courtship campaign waged by Infantino, whose tenure as head of FIFA has come to be defined by his close friendship with Trump. According to Politico, Infantino has logged more FaceTime with Trump this year than any world leader. Earlier this year, as Trump publicly groused about not winning a Nobel Peace Prize, Infantino announced that FIFA would be awarding its own inaugural Peace Prize at the draw. While he did not say who would be the recipient or how the winner would be selected, to say the competition was rigged from its inception became a running joke in Washington. The press for California Governor Gavin Newsom has already taken to mocking the prize as a participation trophy. Now, a peace prize from a body that held its last two World Cups in Qatar and Russia should be taken with a grain of salt the size of Harry Maguire's head. But Trump is never one to turn down an award. He often touts the fact that he was once awarded Statesman of the Year, which he was, though the honor was bestowed upon him by the Sarasota County Republican chapter, whose headquarters is a diminutive office in a strip mall off the I-75. He has also claimed on a number of occasions to have been named Michigan Man of the Year, a distinction that has long confounded fact-checkers since it does not exist. Now Trump is a new one for the speeches. He will no doubt be saying for the rest of his life that he is the recipient of a major peace prize. Infantino's over-the-top courtship of Trump has reportedly caused consternation within FIFA, which is grappling with how to stage a global sports competition under an administration that has proven itself hostile to foreign visitors. The president of the Japanese Football Federation said in an interview last month that he was concerned about deportations happening unnecessarily to Japanese fans. Two nations that qualified for the tournament, Iran and Haiti, are subject to Trump's travel bans. What's more, according to Politico, some at FIFA believe Infantino has catered too much to Trump for a tournament realized through the cooperation of three nations. There were other world leaders and stars at the Kennedy Center on Friday afternoon. Kevin Hart and Heidi Klum played Master of Ceremonies, and Robbie Williams and Nicole Scherzinger performed the new World Cup song. Trump played nice with Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney and Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum, who he appeared with on stage in a display that belied the recent tensions between Trump and the leaders to his north and south over trade and immigration. Both Carney and Sheinbaum gave straightforward statements before the crowd, before Trump went on an extended riff about ticket sales and the time he watched Pele play for the Cosmos. "I assume one of the greats," he said, of one of the late soccer legend. In an offhand remarks that will no doubt stir some controversy, Trump suggested American football be renamed to put an end to the whole soccer farce. "It really doesn't make any sense when you think about it," he said. "This is really football." When the press pool exited the venue to travel back to the White House after Trump's appearance on stage with Carney and Sheinbaum, the pool was recalled to the Kennedy Center after Trump reportedly decided he wanted to stick around and watch the rest. Sat next to Sheinbaum, Trump enjoyed a performance from Lauryn Hill and a pre-recorded skit featuring Manchester United legend Rio Ferdinand, Matthew McConaughey, and Salma Hayek. The event had an undignified start for the journalists sent from around the world to cover it. They waited in a security line stretched outside the Kennedy Center as the temperature hovered below freezing and snow tumbled down. "I've been covering soccer in the U.S. for 7 years," said one frozen reporter, "and this is the worst run event I've ever been to." Some waited for more than 2 hours as an understaffed unit of Secret Service agents checked every pocket of every backpack, opening laptops and pressing buttons, presumably to ensure their non-explosive quality, and confiscating water bottles. This precaution I could not understand. Inside, journalists thawed around tables set up with food representing the World Cup host countries: Canada, poutine; Mexico, tacos; and the United States, burgers. The festivities wrapped up with a performance from the Village People, who seemed to miss their cue for the start of YMCA, but eventually got into the rhythm of things. Trump stood in his box and performed his signature dance while Carney, Sheinbaum, and First Lady Melania Trump remained seated, laughing at the spectacle. Only Infantino stood with Trump. Our next headline in the politics section: journalists react to Trump's latest attack. There needs to be a lot more outrage. One editor, whose publication made the White House's new Media Offender database, says his reporter has been subject to days and days and days of email after being named an onslaught of disgusting, hateful shit. This is by Eric Lutz on December 5th. Unable to quash unfavorable reporting by slinging schoolyard taunts and taking away access, the Trump administration has taken a new tack, putting a target on individual journalists under the guise of calling out media bias. Last week, the White House debuted a so-called media bias portal on its website that catalogs alleged false and misleading stories. Its database, titled the Offender Hall of Shame, is searchable by publication and reporter and flags reports for offenses such as misrepresentation and left-wing lunacy. On Tuesday, the administration added a tip line to the initiative. "Help expose the worst of the worst," the page reads. "If you know of any media outlet misrepresenting the Trump administration and skewing the truth, link the article below for our team to review it." As of Friday afternoon, there were 39 claims recorded on the site. Among them, a New York Times report on the 79-year-old Donald Trump's health and stamina, bias, and malpractice, and several reports about the president's recent suggestion that Democrats should be executed for publishing a video encouraging military personnel not to obey unlawful orders. Trump simply called for them to be held accountable for inciting sedition, according to the White House. The New York Post on Thursday was named Media Offender of the Week for its reporting on the second strike the United States conducted on an alleged drug boat in September to kill two men who had survived the first attack. a potential war crime that has even led some Republicans to express concerns, and that has intensified pressure on Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. The White House claims the Post published an unsubstantiated lie to determine the Department of War's anti-terrorist operations. But to some media figures, what the White House is actually doing with its stunt is obvious. It's the wrongful and intentional targeting of journalists by government officials for exercising a constitutionally protected right, as Post editor Matt Murray said in a statement Thursday night. The Washington Post will not be dissuaded and will continue to report rigorously and accurately in service to all of America. Indeed, the campaign, which includes a cringy Spotify-wrapped style video of fake news, is an obvious intimidation effort. One editor whose publication made the White House's media offender database told me his reporter has been subjected to days and days and days of emails after being named on this site, an onslaught of disgusting, hateful shit. The portal creates a permission structure for attacks against the media without saying explicitly that journalists should be attacked or harmed in any way, as Catherine Jacobson, the U.S., Canada, and Caribbean program director at the Committee to Protect Journalists, told me. They're basically creating a dog whistle for going after certain reporters and news outlets. Attacks on the press have, of course, been a feature of Trump's presidencies. He has long dismissed critical reporting as fake news and casts journalists as the enemy of the people. But his attempts to crack down on the media and free speech have been even more aggressive in his second term. Trump is targeting news organizations with lawsuits. The Pentagon barred access to reporters who would not agree to draconian terms, and the president has tried to use the levers of government to bend media companies to his will, as seen this fall when ABC, following a threat from the Federal Communications Commissioner Chair Brendan Carr, briefly suspended the comedian Jimmy Kimmel over comments he made on his program. In November, Trump threatened to revoke ABC's broadcast license after a reporter asked him a question about the Epstein files that he didn't like. Some of this has been childish, as when Trump called a female reporter piggy amid her attempt to ask him a question on Air Force One, or when White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt responded to a question from a reporter with, "Your mom did," but the White House's media offender database underscores the ways in which Trump's anti-journalism crusade is both puerile and dangerous. If this was happening in another country, we would call it what it is, the CPJ's Jacobson said. There needs to be a lot more outrage. Our next headline, Erica Kirk speaks to the liberal elite and almost sticks the landing. At the New York Times Deal Book Summit, Charlie Kirk's widow and Turning Point USA successor made calls for unity, but floundered when she was challenged on her husband's most controversial views. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on December 4th. As a grieving widow and the CEO of one of the country's most powerful right-wing groups, Erica Kirk is in a rough, tough position when it comes to coherent political messaging. It's been nearly 3 months since her husband, Turning Point USA founder Charlie Kirk, was killed, and she's had to live out a national nightmare in public. In a Fox Nation docuseries and an array of speeches, Kirk has embodied composure on stage and made pleas for political unity, at least until her culture warrior side comes out. During appearance at the New York Times Deal Book Summit on Wednesday, Kirk started by wistfully recalling a less polarized era in which Republicans and Democrats would share lunch after duking it out on the House floor. Later, she promoted a divisive view of her own by insinuating that female voters supported the New York City mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani for reasons beyond his policy positions. "A high percent of his voters were female," she said. "I think there's a tendency, especially when you live in a city like Manhattan, where, again, you're so career-driven and you almost look to the government as a form of replacement for certain things, relationship-wise even, so you see things a little bit differently." Did she mean to say that female voters were all crushing on Mamdani? Kirk paused before offering a slight clarification. "What I don't want to have happen is young women in this city look to the government as a solution to put off having a family or a marriage because you're relying on the government to support you, instead of being united with a husband where you can support yourself and your husband can support and you can all combine together," she said. Times columnist and DealBook founder Andrew Ross Sorkin didn't seem to know how to respond, so he pivoted. J.D. Vance, he replied, asking Kirk what she thought of the vice president's prospects in 2028. Though Kirk has become a national figure since the death of her husband, her selection as the closing speaker at the annual summit for the Times business vertical was unexpected. But Sorkin explained the reason for the decision after the two got on stage. About a year ago, he said, he met and befriended Charlie. The two texted and emailed frequently about their political disagreements. Charlie Kirk was supposed to be here today. He was supposed to be part of a task force that we've been talking about for quite some time, Sorkin said. He decided to instead extend the invitation to Erica Kirk after she spoke ahead of the President Donald Trump at her husband's televised memorial service. I sat and watched the funeral by video, and I watched you, and I sat in awe when you forgave the assassin. It was at that moment I said to myself, I need to talk to Erica, Sorkin explained. The previously planned elements of the DealBook Summit also went forward, with Ben Shapiro there to represent the right-wing internet. When talking to Kirk, though, Sorkin set the stage for a more feelings-forward dialogue. We're going to have an emotional conversation, he told the audience. We do have Kleenex, not for her, but for me. In the months since her husband died, Kirk has appeared in both power suits with Fox News-ready makeup and pious garb with a clean face. On Wednesday, she landed somewhere in between, wearing a demure gray dress and light eyeshadow. Kirk began by discussing her grief and sharing her perspective on her husband's legacy. At moments, she was downright ecumenical when discussing how she had been leaning on her faith. I wasn't up there for anyone else but for the Lord and my husband. Those were the only two people in my quote-unquote audience, she said of her game-time decision to forgive her husband's killer. That's the Lord. That's my faith, and I don't expect everyone to understand that. Eventually, Sorkin pivoted to the necessary political questions. He noted that some female colleagues at the Times wanted him to ask Kirk how she planned to balance parenting with her new role as CEO, given her previous urgings for mothers to prioritize their families and stay home with their children. There really is no such thing as balance, she said. There is really no blueprint of what I'm going through. It's really a one-of-one type of situation. She originally had different views on working women, Kirk said, but Charlie essentially plucked me out of New York City orbit and was like, I have a healthier way of viewing things and looking at life, and he was right. Now, she said, she has help from those around her. I bring my children to the office. I have them with me constantly. We have a phenomenal team. It doesn't just fall on my shoulders. Considering the somber circumstances, it's understandable that Sorkin didn't know how hard to push back against his guest, but it's difficult to imagine this veteran journalist allowing another interview subject to evade a straightforward question about whether they believe the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was a mistake, something Kirk's husband asserted during his lifetime. My husband, just because he would make certain statements, did not mean that he was trying to rile up a certain part of people. He was trying to, again, go after ideas, not people. He was trying to get people to think a little bit differently, Kirk replied when Sorkin brought this up. It might make people uncomfortable. It might make dialogue uncomfortable, but there's growth in that. Sorkin didn't follow up further. Kirk had taken the stage immediately after Gavin Newsom, who demurred when Sorkin asked about his future plans should he not be governor or president. The California governor expressed his desire to avoid the question by quoting former Supreme Court Justice Louis J. Brandeis. In a democracy, the most important office is not governor, mayor, or president. In a democracy, the most important office is office of citizen, he said. It was an apt phrase to have in mind while listening to Kirk, who had the poise and even-tempered nature of a natural political candidate. But as the CEO of Turning Point, she might have more influence over the future of the Republican Party from the sidelines. And if she stays in that position, she won't have to come to a concrete conclusion about civil rights law. Kirk is, however, getting better at making an emotional appeal when she needs to. On stage Wednesday, Kirk said that social media insults no longer register to her. Especially after he was murdered, I took it all off my phone, she said. When you kiss the bloody dead body of the person you love, it pales in comparison to be calling XYZ. Our next headline, the Department of what? Pete Hegseth can't make the kill everybody questions go away. Even members of the defense secretary's own party are concerned, though a rather drowsy Trump is still standing by him. This is by Eric Lutz on December 3rd. Pete Hegseth has deployed his signature blend of belligerence and blame shifting in an effort to shut down questions about his involvement in a potential war crime. Yet scrutiny of the defense secretary has only continued to intensify, even with even some Republicans on Capitol Hill raising questions and promising to investigate the military's reported second strike on a Venezuelan boat in September. If that occurred, that would be very serious. Mike Turner, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, said on CBS News' Face the Nation Sunday, that would be an illegal act. Last week, The Intercept and The Washington Post reported that earlier this fall, SEAL Team 6 conducted a double-tap strike on what was described as a drug boat after two men survived the initial attack. The follow-up, the Post reported, was ordered to comply with a spoken directive from Hegseth to kill everybody on board. Hegseth has broadly defended the military campaign in the Caribbean and these likely illegal tactics, which align with the vision of a warrior ethos, unbound by stupid rules of engagement that he outlined in a meeting with generals in September. But Hegseth has also tried to dance around questions about the second strike, describing the reports as fake news and claiming the directive was actually issued by the commander in charge of the operation, Admiral Frank Bradley. Bradley has declined to comment on the matter. "I watched that first strike live," Hegseth told reporters Tuesday, but moved on to my next meeting before the second. President Donald Trump has similarly tried to distance himself from the strike. "I didn't know about the second strike. I didn't know anything about the people," he said Tuesday. "I wasn't involved, and I knew they took out a boat, but I would say this, they had a strike." But Hegseth's response has failed to quiet critics, including those within his own party. On Tuesday, Senator Rand Paul spoke with skepticism about a social media post in which the defense secretary described reports of a second strike as fabricated. "Either he was lying to us," said Paul, "or he's incompetent and didn't know it had happened." Senator Roger Wicker, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, has promised vigorous oversight in response to the reports, despite White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt saying that Hegseth already spoke with lawmakers who may have expressed some concerns over the weekend. If it is substantiated, whoever made that order needs to get the hell out of Washington, GOP Senator Tom Tillis told CNN Tuesday. "I've seen enough." Republican Representative Don Bacon added that, "I don't think Hegseth is the right leader." Trump has stood by Hegseth so far, as he did during the defense secretary's Signalgate scandal earlier this year. "Everybody at this table has done a fantastic job," the rather drowsy president said during a cabinet meeting Tuesday, amid questions about the standing of Hegseth, FBI Director Kash Patel, and other administration officials. But Hegseth and other embattled Trump officials increasingly seem to be a liability to the president himself, as he faces declining approval ratings and some fractures within his normally unified party. Indeed, while many in MAGA world deferred to Trump and Hegseth, "I don't think there needs to be additional oversight," Senator Tommy Tuberville told Politico. "Some key allies of the president have expressed concern about the second strike. I'm not comfortable with the two blow," West Virginia Senator Jim Justice told MS Now on Tuesday. Whether this scrutiny results in accountability for Hegseth, let alone Trump, is hard to say. But it all would seem to reinforce the message a group of Democratic lawmakers issued in a video last month, in which the six members, all with military or intelligence backgrounds, urged troops to refuse unlawful orders. Trump responded to that message by accusing the Democrats of seditious behavior and suggesting they should be executed. Leavitt implied that all orders issued by the president are legal, and the FBI is reportedly investigating the Democratic lawmakers over the video. "If there is anyone who needs to answer questions in public and under oath," Senator Mark Kelly, one of the Democrats, said in a press conference when referring to the Venezuelan boat strikes, "it is Pete Hegseth." Okay, we do have enough time for the Proust questionnaire. Ruth E. Carter is Ryan Coogler's go-to costume designer. She's a two-time Oscar winner who breathed life into Spike Lee's earlier masterpieces and conjured up Black Panther's signature style. This is published on December 2nd. Vanity Fair asks Ruth E. Carter, what is your idea of perfect happiness? Having the ability to get up in the morning with no deadlines, walk a mile just before the sun rises, yoga after that, eat a healthy breakfast with my coffee, sit down with a book, and start a new canvas. What is your greatest fear? Oversleeping on the biggest day of a film when the number one star has a new costume to establish. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Rosa Parks. Which living person do you most admire? My older sister, Debbie. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I can't say no to ice cream after a meal. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Miscommunication and lack of initiative. What is your greatest extravagance? Gucci pajamas. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Virginity. On what occasion do you lie? During the questionnaire that my doctor gives me. What do you dislike about your appearance? Honestly, nothing. I've accepted who I am inside and out. Which living person do you most despise? Anybody who hurts a child. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My dog, Koki. When and where were you happiest? At the pyramids in Egypt on the set of Malcolm X. Which talent would you most like to have? Picking the winning lottery numbers. What is your current state of mind? Peaceful bliss. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? That they would take care of themselves and each other more. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Paying off my mother's house and seeing my designs in my current traveling exhibition. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A thing. I'd come back as an ocean. What is your most treasured possession? My Oscars. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Boredom. Where would you like to live? At home. I'm always on the road. What do you most value in your friends? Humor and intellect. Who are your favorite writers? Ryan Coogler and Shonda Rhimes. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? The Dora Milaje or Adored Ones, the all-female elite warriors that served as the bodyguard to the Black Panther and protectors of the nation of Wakanda. What are your favorite names? Zinzi, Yara. What is it that you most dislike? When people aren't truthful about their abilities and I buy into it. How would you like to die? In my sleep? What is your motto? Trust your voice. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Once again, thanks for listening, and have a great week, everybody.